ashes to ashes. To Kalanga's hungry people, our father promised at summer's end the bounty of the Lord, more fish than they had ever seen in their lives. "The word of Christ is beloved," he cries, standing up precariously in his boat. "Tata Jesus is Bangala." So determined he is to win or force or drag them over to the way of the cross. "Feed the belly first," he announced at dinner one night, seized with his brilliant plan. "Feed the belly, and the soul will come." Not having noticed, for a wife is beneath notice, that this is exactly what our mother did when she killed all the chickens. But after the underwater thunder, what came was not souls, but fish. They came rolling to the surface with mouths opened wide by that shocking boom. Round, shocked bubbles for eyes. The whole village feasted all day, ate till we felt bug-eyed and belly up ourselves. He performed a backward version of the loaves and fishes, trying to stuff 10,000 fish into 50 mouths, did the Reverend Price. Slogging up and down the riverbank in trousers wet to the knees, his Bible in one hand and another stickful of fire-blackened fish in the other, he waved his bounty in a threatening manner. Thousands more fish jerked in the sun and went bad along the riverbanks. Our village was blessed for weeks with the smell of putrefaction. Instead of abundance, it was a holiday of waste. No ice. Our father forgot. For fishing in the style of modern redneck Georgia, you need ice. He was not going to bring up the loaves and fishes in today's sermon was a good guess. He would merely give out the communion with the usual disturbing allusions to eating flesh and drinking blood. Perhaps this perked up congregational interest, but we Price girls all listened with half an ear between us. And Ada with her half a brain, ha! Huh. The church service lasts twice as long now because the Reverend has to say it once in English, and then the schoolteacher, Tata Anatole, repeats it all in Kikongo. Our father finally caught on. Nobody was understanding his horrible stabs at French or Kikongo, either one. "It was lawlessness that came forth from Babylon. Lawlessness," declared the Reverend, waving an arm impressively toward Babylon as if that turbulent locale lurked just behind the school latrine. Through the bedraggled roof, a ray of sun fell like God's spotlight across his right shoulder. He paced, paused, spoke, and paced behind his palm leaf altar, giving every impression he was inventing his biblical parables on the spot. This morning he was spinning the tale of Susanna, beautiful and pious wife of the rich man Joachim. Anasus ho, O Susanna. While she bathed in the garden, two of Joachim's advisers spied her naked and cooked up their vile plan. They leaped from the bushes and demanded that she lie down with them. Poor Susanna. If she refused, they would bear false witness against her, claiming they caught her in the garden with a man. Naturally, the righteous Susanna refused them, even though this meant she would be accused and stoned for adultery. Stoning, moaning, owning, deboning. We were not supposed to wonder what kind of husband was this Joachim who would kill his own lovely wife rather than listen to her side of the story. No doubt the Babylonians were already out scouting around for their favorite rocks. The Reverend paused, resting one hand flat on the altar. The rest of his body rocked almost imperceptibly inside his white shirt, marking time, keeping his rhythm. He scrutinized his parishioners' blank faces for signs that they were on the edge of their seats. There were 11 or 12 new faces now, a regular stampede to glory. A boy near me, with his mouth hanging open, closed one eye, then the other, back and forth. We all waited for Tata Anatole, the schoolteacher translator, to catch up. "But God would not let this happen," the Reverend growled like a dog awakened by a prowler. Then rising an octave like the Star-Spangled Banner, "God stirred up the Holy Spirit of a man named Daniel." Oh, hooray, Daniel to the rescue. Our father loves Daniel, the original private eye. Tata Daniel, he called him to make him seem like a local boy, stepped in and demanded to question the two advisers separately. Tata Daniel asked them what kind of tree Susanna was supposedly standing under when she met this man in the garden. A mastic tree, said one, and the other, well, gee, I guess it was a live oak. How stupid that they had not even conspired to get their story straight. All the evildoers in the Bible seem spectacularly dumb. I watched Tata Anatole, expecting him at least to stumble over mastic and live oak, as there could not possibly be words for these trees in Kikongo. He did not pause. Kufwema, Kuzikisa, Kugambola. Smoothly the words rolled forward, and I realized this slick, trick schoolteacher could be saying anything under the sun. Our father would never be the wiser. So they stoned the dame and married two more wives apiece and lived happily ever after. I yawned, uninspired yet again by the pious and beautiful Susanna. I was unlikely ever to have her problems. In my mind, I invented cinema hymns, as I call them, my own perverse hymns that can be sung equally well forward or backward. Evil, all its sin, is still alive. Also, I made use of this rare opportunity to inspect Mama Tataba at close range. Normally, she moved much too fast. I considered her my ally because, like me, she was imperfect. It was hard to say what she ever thought of our father's benedictions in church or out, so I pondered more interesting mysteries, such as her eye. How did she lose it? Was she exempt from marriage because of it, as I presumed myself to be? I had little idea of her age or hopes. I did know that many women in Kilanga were more seriously disfigured and had husbands notwithstanding. Standing with naught. Husbands. Here, bodily damage is more or less considered to be a byproduct of living, not a disgrace. In the way of the body and other people's judgment, I enjoy a benign approval in Kilanga that I have never, ever known in Bethlehem, Georgia. We finished off Susanna by singing Amazing Grace at the speed of a dirge. The ragtag congregation chimed in with every sort of word and tune. Oh, we were a regular Tower of Babel here at the First Baptist Church of Kilanga, so no one noticed that I mouthed my own words to the proper tune. Evil all, its sin is still alive. Do go ta-ta to God. Sugar don't no drag us drawn onward. Ah, heroes, ye eyesore, ha. When church was over, Mama Tataba took us back to the house, while the clever reverend and his wife stayed behind to smile and shake hands and bask in the general holiness. Mama Tataba stomped down the path ahead of my sisters and me. Bringing up the rear, I concentrated on trying to pass up the dawdling Rachel, who walked with her hands held out slightly from her thighs, as if she had once again, as usual, been crowned Miss America. Hold your hands like you've just dropped a marble, she instructs us generally as she fashion models her way through the house. In spite of all that stateliness, I could not catch up, so I watched an orange and white butterfly that hovered over her and finally lit on her white head. The butterfly poked its tiny proboscis down into her hair, probing for nurture, then flew away unsatisfied. Mama Tataba saw none of these events. She was in a bad mood and shouted at us confidentially, Reverend Price, he better be give that up. Flesh-eating and blood-drinking, did she mean? The sermon had meandered from the pious Susanna to Rahab, the harlot of Jericho. So many biblical names sound backward, like Rahab. I wonder sometimes if the whole thing was written by a mental freak like me. But in the end, he got around to emphasizing baptism, as always. This was likely what disturbed Mama Tataba. Our father could not seem to accept what seemed clear enough even to a child. When he showered the idea of baptism, batiza, on people here, it shrunk them away like water on a witch. Later on at the dinner table, he was still animated, though, which is the status quo on Sundays. Once he gets wound up in the pulpit, he seems unwilling to give up center stage. Do you know, he asked us, tall and bright-headed like a candle in his chair, last year some men drove here all the way from Leopoldville in a truck with a broken fan belt, a Mercedes truck. Ah me, one of his Socratic moods. This was not dangerous, for he rarely actually struck us at the table, but it was designed to show us all up as dull-witted bovine females. He always ended these interrogations with an exasperated, loud, private conversation with God concerning our hopelessness. Methuselah was definitely in the girls' camp. He made a habit of prattling at the top of his lungs through Sunday dinners at our house. Like many human beings, he took the least sign of conversation as his cue to make noise. Our mother sometimes threw a tablecloth over his cage in frustration. Mbote, mbote, he screamed now, which in Kikongo means hello and goodbye both. This symmetry appeals to me. Many Kikongo words resemble English words backward and have antithetical meanings. Siyebo is a horrible, destructive rain that just exactly does not do what it says backward, obeys. We listened vaguely to our father's tale of the putative Mercedes truck. Our only material goods from the outside world of late were comic books, which my sisters cherished like Marco Polo's spices from China, and powdered eggs and milk, to which we felt indifferent, all brought by Eben Axelrod. As for this truck and fan belt story, the Reverend loved to speak in parables, and we could surely spot one coming. That road, said our mother, bemused, gesturing with a lazy bent wrist out the window. Why, I can't imagine. She shook her head, possibly not believing. Can she allow herself not to believe him? I have never known. It was at the end of a dry season, Orleana, he snapped. When it's hot enough, the puddles dry up. You brainless nitwit, he did not need to add. But how on earth did they run it without fan belt, our mother asked, understanding by the Reverend's irritation that she was expected to return to the subject at hand. She leaned forward to offer him biscuits from the bone china platter, which she sometimes secretly cradled like a baby after the washing and drying. Today she gave its rim a gentle stroke before folding her hands in submission to Father's will. She was wearing a jaunty shirtwaist, white with small red and blue semaphore flags. It had been her outermost dress when we came over. Its frantic little banners seemed to be signaling distress now on account of Mama Tataba's vigorous washings in the river. He leaned forward to give us the full effect of his red eyebrows and prominent jaw. "Elephant grass," he pronounced triumphantly. We sat frozen, the food in our mouths momentarily unchewed. A dozen little boys rode on the back, weaving fan belts out of grass. Leah blurted out all in a rush, "So the plain simple grass of God's creation can be just as strong as rubber or whatnot." She sat ramrod straight as if she were on television going for the $64 question. "No," he said, "each one wouldn't last but 2 or 3 miles. "Oh," Leah was disconsolate. The remaining nitwits ventured no other guesses. "But just as soon as it gave out," he explained, "well, they'd have another one at the ready." "Keen," Rachel said unconvincingly. She is the most dramatic member of the family and the worst actress, which in our family is a crucial skill. All of us were giving diligent attention to our powdered potatoes. We were supposed to be reaching an understanding here about the elephant grass fan belt illustrating God's vast greatness. Nobody wanted to be called on. "A Mercedes truck," he said finally, "the pinnacle of German invention, can be kept in business by 12 little African boys and some elephant grass." "Sister, shut the door! Winda, Mbote!" Methuselah called out. Then he shouted, "Ko, ko, ko," which is what people in Kalanga shout in someone's doorway when they come visiting, since generally there is no door to knock on. This happened often at our house, but we always knew it was Methuselah since we did have a door and did not, as a rule, have visitors. If anyone actually ever came, usually in the hope of selling us food, they did not knock on the door but merely hung about the yard until we took notice. "Well, I expect you could keep anything going with enough little boys and enough grass," our mother said. She did not sound all that pleased about it. "That's right. It just takes adaptability." "Damn, damn, damn," observed Methuselah. Mother shot the bird a worried glance. "If that creature lives through 900 Baptist missions, he will have quite a lot to say." She stood up then and started stacking the plates. Her living curl had long since been pronounced dead, and on the whole she appeared to be adapted to within an inch of her life. She excused herself to go boil the dishwater. Unable to work either the dishwater or Methuselah's long memory into a proper ending for his parable, our father merely looked at us all and heaved the great sigh of the put-upon male. Oh, such a sigh! It was so deep it could have drawn water from a well right up from beneath the floor of our nitwit household. He was merely trying, that sigh suggested, to drag us all toward enlightenment through the marrow of our own poor female bones. We hung our heads, pushed back our chairs, and filed out to help stoke up the firebox in the kitchen house. Cooking meals here requires half the day, and cleaning up takes the other half. We have to boil our water because it comes from the stream where parasites multiply in teeming throngs. Africa has parasites so particular and diverse as to occupy every niche of the body. Intestines, small and large, the skin, the bladder, the male and female reproductive tracts, interstitial fluids, even the cornea. In a library book on African public health before we left home, I found a drawing of a worm as thin as a hair meandering across the front of a man's startled eyeball. I was struck through with my own wayward brand of reverence. Praise be the Lord of all plagues and secret afflictions. If God had amused himself inventing the lilies of the field, he surely knocked his own socks off with the African parasites. Outside, I saw Mama Tataba on her way to the kitchen house, dip in a hand and drink straight out of the bucket. I crossed my fingers for her one good eye. I shuddered to think of that dose of God's creation going down, sucking her dry from the inside. Leah. My father had been going to the garden alone every day to sit and think. It disturbed him that the plants thrived and filled the fence patch with bloom like a funeral parlor, but would not set fruit. I knew he was praying about it. I sometimes went out to sit with him, even though Mother held it against me, saying he needed his solitude. He speculated that there was too much shade from the trees. I thought long and hard about this explanation, as I am always eager to expand my understanding of horticulture. It was true the trees did encroach on our little clearing. We constantly had to break and hack off branches trying to win back our ground, while some of the bean vines had wound themselves all the way into the very treetops, striving for light. Once he asked me suddenly as we sat mulling over the pumpkins, "Leah, do you know what they spent the last Bible convention in Atlanta arguing about?" I wasn't really expected to know, so I waited. I was thrilled by the mere fact of his speaking to me in this gentle, somewhat personal way. He didn't look at me, of course, because he had much on his mind, as ever. We'd worked so hard for God's favor, yet it seemed God was still waiting for some extra labor on our part, and it was up to my father to figure out what. With his stronger eye, he stared deeply into a pumpkin blossom for the source of his garden's disease. The flowers would open and close, then the green fruits behind them would shrivel and turn brown. There wasn't a single exception. In exchange for our honest sweat, we'd so far earned flowers and leaves, but nothing we could actually have for supper. "The size of heaven," he finally said. "I'm sorry." My heart skipped a beat. Here I'd been trying to second-guess Father working out the garden business. He is always two steps ahead of me. They debated about the size of heaven at the Bible convention. How many furlongs it is, how many long, how many wide. They set men with adding machines to figuring it out. Chapter 21 of Revelation sets it out in reeds, and other books tell it in cubits, and not a one of them quite matches up. Inexplicably, he sounded put out with the men who brought their adding machines to the Bible convention, and possibly with the Bible itself. I felt extremely uneasy. "Well, I sure hope there'll be room enough for everybody," I said. This was a whole new worry to me. Suddenly I began to think of all the people already up there, mostly old and not in particularly good shape either. I pictured them elbowing each other as if at a church rummage sale. "There will always be room for the righteous," he said. "Amen," I breathed, on safer ground. "Many are the afflictions of the righteous, and the Lord delivers him out of all of them. But you know, Leah, sometimes he doesn't deliver us out of our hardships, but through them." "Heavenly Father, deliver us," I said, although I didn't care for this new angle. Father had already bent his will to Africa by remaking his garden in mounds the way they do here. This was a sure sign to God of his humility and servitude, and it was only fair to expect our reward. So what was this business of being delivered through hardships? Did Father aim to suggest God was not obligated to send us down any beans or squash at all, no matter how we might toil in his name? That he just proposed to sit up there and consign us to hardships, one right after another? Certainly it wasn't my place to scrutinize God's great plan, but what about the balancing scales of justice? Father said nothing to ease my worries. He just plucked up another bean flower and held it up to the sky, examining it in the African light like a doctor with an X-ray, looking for the secret thing gone wrong. His first sermon in August waxed great and long on the subject of baptism. Afterward at home, when Mother asked Mama Tataba to go put the soup on the stove, Mama Tataba turned and walked smack dab out the front door in between the words soup and stove. She went out and gave my father a good talking to, shaking her finger at him across a row of tomatoless tomato plants. Whatever it was he'd done wrong in her opinion, it was really the last straw. We could hear her voice rising and rising. Naturally, it shocked us half to death to hear somebody caterwauling at Father this way. It shocked us even more to see him standing there red-faced trying to fit in a word sideways. With all four of us girls lined up at the window with our mouths gaping open, we must have looked like the Lennon sisters on Lawrence Welk. Mother shooed us from the window, ordering us to go hunt up our school books and read them. It wasn't the proper time for school or even a school day, but we did everything she said now. We'd recently seen her throw a box of potato buds across the room. After a quiet eternity of the Trojan War, Mama Tataba burst in and threw her apron on a chair. We all closed our books. "I won't be stay here," she declared. "You send a girl, get me at Bunga, you be need help. I go show you cook eel. They got a big eel down a river yesterday. That fish a good be for children." That was her final advice for our salvation. I followed her out the door and watched her tromp down the road, the pale soles of her feet blinking back at me. Then I went to track down my father, who had wandered a little distance from the fenced garden and was sitting against a tree trunk. In his fingers, he carefully stretched out something that looked like a wasp, still alive. It was as broad as my hand and had a yellow 8 on each clear wing, as plain as if some careful schoolchild, or God, had painted it there. My father looked like he'd just had a look down Main Street, heaven. He told me, "There aren't any pollinators." "What?" "No insects here to pollinate the garden." "Why, but there's a world of bugs here." An unnecessary remark, I suppose, as we both watched the peculiar insect struggling in his hands. African bugs, Leah. Creatures fashioned by God for the purpose of serving African plants. Look at this thing. How would it know what to do with a Kentucky Wonder Bean? I couldn't know if he was right or wrong. I only faintly understood about pollination. I do know that the industrious bees do the most of it. I mused. I guess we should have brought some bees over in our pockets, too. My father looked at me with a new face, strange and terrifying to me for what it lacked in confidence. It was as if a small, befuddled stranger were peering through the imposing mask of my father's features. He looked at me like I was his spanking newborn baby, and he did love me so, but feared the world would never be what any of us had hoped for. "Leah," he said, "you can't bring the bees. You might as well bring the whole world over here with you, and there's not room for it." I swallowed. "I know." We sat together looking through the crooked stick fence at the great variety of spurned blossoms in my father's garden. I felt so many different things right then, elation at my father's strange expression of tenderness and despair for his defeat. We had worked so hard, and for what? I felt confusion and dread. I sensed that the sun was going down on many things I believed in. From his big cage on the porch, Methuselah screeched at us in Kikongo. "Mbote," he said, and I merely wondered, hello or goodbye. What was Mama Tataba so mad about just now? I dared to ask, very quietly. We saw her hollering. A little girl. She has one? No, a girl from here in the village that got killed last year. I felt my pulse race ahead. What happened to her? He did not look at me now, but stared off at the distance. She got killed and eaten by a crocodile. They don't let their children step foot in the river, ever, not even to be washed in the blood of the lamb. Oh, I said. My own baptism and everyone I've witnessed so far took place in something like a large bathtub or small swimming pool in the Baptist church. The worst harm that could come to you might be that you would slip on the stairs. I hope there would be room in heaven for that poor little girl in whatever condition she'd arrived there. I fail to understand, he said, why it would take 6 months for someone to inform me of that simple fact. The old fire was seeping back into this strange, wistful husk of my father. I felt gratified. "Ko, ko, ko," Methuselah called. "Come in," my father retorted, with impatience rising in his craw. "Wake up, brother fowls!" "Piss off," my father shouted. I held my breath. He shoved himself straight to his feet, strode to the porch, and flung open the door of Methuselah's cage. Methuselah hunched his shoulders and sidled away from the door. His eyes in their bulging sockets ticked up and down, trying to understand the specter of this huge white man. "You're free to go," my father said, waiting. But the bird did not come out, so he reached in and took hold of it. In my father's hands, Methuselah looked like nothing but a feathered toy. When he hurled the bird up at the treetops, it didn't fly at first, but only sailed across the clearing like a red-tailed badminton shuttlecock. I thought my father's rough grip had surely got the better of that poor native creature and that it would fall to the ground. But no. In a burst of light, Methuselah opened his wings and fluttered like freedom itself, lifting himself to the top of our Kentucky wonder vines and the highest boughs of the jungle that will surely take back everything once we are gone. Book 2, The Revelation. And I stood upon the sand of the sea and saw a beast rise up. If any man have an ear, let him hear. Revelation 13:1-9. Orleana Price, Sanderling Island, Georgia. Once every few years, even now, I catch the scent of Africa. It makes me want to keen, sing, clap up thunder, lie down at the foot of a tree and let the worms take whatever of me they can still use. I find it impossible to bear. Ripe fruits, acrid sweat, urine, flowers, dark spices, and other things I've never even seen. I can't say what goes into the composition or why it rises up to confront me as I round some corner hastily, unsuspecting. It has found me here on this island in our little town, in a back alley where sleek boys smoke in a stairwell amidst the day's uncollected refuse. A few years back, it found me on the Gulf Coast of Mississippi, where I'd returned for a family funeral. Africa rose up to seize me as I walked on a pier past a huddle of turtle-headed old fishermen, their bait buckets set around them like a banquet. Once I merely walked out of the library in Atlanta, And there it was, that scent knocking me down for no reason I can understand. The sensation rises up from inside me, and I know you're still here, holding sway. You've played some trick on the dividing of my cells so my body can never be free of the small parts of Africa it consumed. Africa, where one of my children remains in the dank red earth. It's the scent of accusation. It seems I only know myself anymore by your attendance in my soul. I could have been a different mother, you'll say. Could have straightened up and seen what was coming, for it was thick in the air all around us. It was the very odor of market day in Kilunga. Every fifth day was market day, not the 7th or 30th, nothing you could give a name like Saturday or the 1st of the month, but every thumb, if you kept the days in your hand. It makes no sense at all, and then, finally, all the sense in the world, once you understand that keeping things in your hand is exactly how it's done in the Congo. From everywhere within walking distance, every fifth day, people with hands full or empty appeared in our village to saunter and haggle their way up and down the long rows where women laid out produce on mats on the ground. The vendor ladies squatted, scowling, resting their chins on their crossed arms, behind fortresses of stacked kola nuts, bundles of fragrant sticks, piles of charcoal, salvaged bottles and cans, or displays of dried animal parts. They grumbled continually as they built and rebuilt with leathery, deliberate hands their pyramids of mottled greenish oranges and mangoes and curved embankments of hard green bananas. I took a deep breath and told myself that a woman anywhere on earth can understand another woman on market day. Yet my eye could not decipher those vendors. They wrapped their heads in bright-colored cloths as cheerful as a party, but faced the world with permanent, vile frowns. They slung back their heads in slit-eyed boredom while they did each other's hair into starbursts of astonished spikes. However I might pretend I was their neighbor, they knew better. I was pale and wide-eyed as a fish in the dust of the marketplace, trying to swim, while all the other women calmly breathed in that atmosphere of overripe fruit, dried meat, sweat, and spices, infusing their lives with powers I feared. One particular day haunts me. I was trying to keep track of my girls, but could see only Leah. I recall she was in the pale blue dress with the sash that tied behind her back. All the girls but Rachel generally ran ragged, so this must have been for our family a Sunday, a coincidence of our big day and the villagers. Leah had a basket in her arms, carrying for me some burden that held her back from her preferred place at the head of the pack. The others had moved out of sight. I knew Nathan would be impatient for our return, so I beckoned to Leah. She had to cross over a row of produce to get to me. Without a thought, as the twin whose legs never failed her, she shifted the basket to her left hip and took a giant step over a pyramid of oranges. I stretched out my hand to her. Right there, as she reached for it, though, she got stuck somehow mid-straddle over the oranges, unable to bring the other foot over. The woman squatting beside the oranges leaped up hissing, slicing her hands like scissor blades at the two of us, scorching me with eyes so hot the angry chocolate irises seemed to be melting into the white. A row of men on a bench looked up from their bowls of new beer and stared at us with the same clouded eyes, all motioning for me to move my child, stupid ghost, non-person, straddling a woman's market day wealth. I can't stop being embarrassed by the memory of myself and Leah there with her genitals, bare for all anyone knew, suspended over a woman's oranges. A foreign mother and child assuming themselves in charge, suddenly slapped down to nothing by what they all saw us to be. Until that moment, I'd thought I could have it both ways, to be one of them and also my husband's wife. What conceit! I was his instrument, his animal, nothing more. How we wives and mothers do perish at the hands of our own righteousness. I was just one more of those women who clamp their mouths shut and wave the flag as their nation rolls off to conquer another in war. Guilty or innocent, they have everything to lose. They are what there is to lose. A wife is the earth itself, changing hands, bearing scars. We would all have to escape Africa by a different route. Some of us are in the ground now, and some are above it, but we're all women made of the same scarred earth. I study my grown daughters now for signs they are resting in some kind of peace. How did they manage? When I remain hounded by judgment. The eyes in the trees open onto my dreams. In daylight they watch my crooked hands while I scratch the soil in my little damp garden. What do you want from me? When I raise up my crazy old eyes and talk to myself, what do you want me to tell you? Oh, little beast, little favorite, can't you see I died as well? Sometimes I pray to remember. Other times I pray to forget. It makes no difference. How can I ever walk free in the world after the clap of those hands in the marketplace that were plainly trying to send me away? I had warnings. How can I bear the scent of what catches up to me? There was so little time to ponder right and wrong when I hardly even knew where I was. In those early months, why, half the time I would wake up startled and think I was right back in Pearl, Mississippi. Before marriage, before religion, before everything. Mornings in the Congo were so steamy you couldn't see a thing but cloud come to earth, so you might as well be anywhere. Mama Tataba would appear to me, standing in the bedroom doorway in her olive-green cardigan half-buttoned up with the $5 holes in the elbows, a knit cap of pilled wool pulled down to her eyebrows, her hands thick as hide. She could have been a woman standing in the alley door of Lutton's General Store in the year of Our Lord and my childhood, 1939. Then she'd say, "Mama Prize, a mongoose begot in the white flower." And I would have to hold on to the bed frame while the landscape swirled like water down a drain and pulled me back to the center. Here. Now. How in the world did a person get to be where I was? Everything turned on the day we lost them both, Mama Tataba and the accursed parrot, both released by Nathan. What a day that was. For the native members of our household, Independence Day, the bird hung around, casting his vexed eye down on us from the tree still needing to be fed. The other, she on whom our lives depended, vanished from the village. And the rain poured down, and I wondered, are we lost right now without knowing it? It had already happened so many times in my life, my wedding day comes to mind, that I thought I was out of the woods, not realizing I'd merely paused on the edge of another narrow precipice in the midst of a long, long fall. I can still recite the litany of efforts it took to push a husband and children alive and fed through each day in the Congo. The longest journey always began with sitting up in bed at the rooster's crow, parting the mosquito curtain, and slipping on shoes, for there were hookworms lying in wait on the floor, itching to burrow into our bare feet. Shoes, then, sliding me across the floor to greet the day, dreaming of coffee. I'm afraid I didn't miss the physical presence of my husband in his absences as much as I missed coffee. Out the back door, into the shock of damp heat, straining for a look at the river, resisting the urge to run. Oh, that river of wishes, the slippery crocodile dream of it, how it might have carried my body down through all the glittering sandbars to the sea. The hardest work of every day was deciding, once again, to stay with my family. They never even knew. When I pried open the lock meant to keep the beasts and curious children out of our kitchen hut, I nearly had to lock it again behind me to keep myself in. The gloom, the humidity, the permanent sour breath of rainy season all bore down on me like a bothersome lover. The fresh stench of night soil in the bushes, and our own latrine, which was only one step removed. Standing at the work table, I would leave my own thoughts and watch myself murdering oranges with our single, dull knife, slitting their bellies and squeezing out the red blood. But no, first the fruit had to be washed. These strange, so-called blood oranges were gathered wild from the forest. When I bought them from Mama Mokala, I knew they'd pass through the hands of her boys, all of whom bore white crusts on their eyes and penises, washed then with a drop of precious Clorox bleach, measured out like the blood of the lamb. It's comical, I know, but I carried through those days the image of a popular advertising campaign from home that pictured teams of very soiled children under the bold invocation, "Clorox needed here." Very well, then. The juice wrenched from the disinfected skin, and then the pulpy liquid had to be diluted with water if I hoped to make the precious oranges last at all. It's hard to say which cost me more dearly, bleach, oranges, or water. Bleach and oranges both I had to bargain for or beg for in the case of supplies flown into us by the awful man, Eben Axelrod. Every few weeks he turned up without warning, a sudden apparition in rotten boots and sweat-stained fedora, smoking tipperillos in my doorway and demanding money for things that were already ours, donated by the Mission League. He even sold us our mail. But then nothing came to us free, not even water. It had to be carried a mile and a half and boiled. Boiled, a small word, meant 20 minutes over a roaring fire on a stove that resembled the rusted carcass of an Oldsmobile. Fire meant gathering up a pile of sticks in a village that had already been gathering firewood for all the years since God was a child, picking its grounds clean of combustibles as efficiently as an animal combing itself for lice. So fire meant longer and longer forays into the forest, stealing fallen branches from under the blunt-eyed gaze of snakes, just for one single bucket of drinkable water. Every small effort at hygiene was magnified by hours of labor spent procuring the simplest elements, water, heat, anything that might pass for disinfectant. And food, that was another song and dance. Finding it, learning its name, cutting or pounding or dashing its brains to make it into something my family would tolerate. For a long time, I could not work out how all the other families were getting by. There seemed to be no food to speak of, even on a market day when everybody came around to make the tallest possible pile out of what they had. It didn't seem to stack up to enough sustenance for the 24 families in our village. Yes, I could see there was charcoal for cooking it, and shriveled red pili-pili peppers for spicing it, and calabash bowls to put it in. But where was the it, whatever it was? What on God's earth did they eat? At length, I learned the answer, a gluey paste called fufu. It comes from a stupendous tuber which the women cultivate and dig from the ground, soak in the river, dry in the sun, pound to white powder and hollowed out logs, and boil. It's called manioc, I was informed by Jana Underdown. It has the nutritional value of a brown paper bag with the added bonus of trace amounts of cyanide. Yet it fills the stomach. It cooks up into the sort of tasteless mass one might induce an American child to try once after a long round of pulled-up noses and double-dog dares. But for the people of Kilanga, fufu was the one thing in life, other than time, that appeared to be taken for granted. There will always be manioc. It is the center of life. When the tall, narrow women, dressed in their sarongs, returned serenely from the fields, they toted it in huge parcels impossibly balanced on their heads— manioc root bundles the size of crumpled horses. After soaking and peeling it, they arranged the long white roots into upright sprays in enamel tubs and passed single file through the village like immense lilies on slender moving stalks. These women spent their days in the steady labors of planting, digging, and pounding manioc, though the dreamy way they moved through that work made it seem entirely separate from any end product. They reminded me of the groups of black men called Gandhi dancers in the Old South, who would come along the railroad track chanting, nodding, stepping forward and back in unison, banging out a rhythm with their steel rods, captivating children and moving on before you realize they had also, incidentally, repaired the track. That is how these women produced manioc, and that is how their children ate it, with no apparent thought to the higher purposes of production and consumption. Fufu was simply another word for food. Any other thing a person might eat, a banana, an egg, the bean called mangwansi, a piece of fire-blackened antelope flesh, was just the opposite, and its consumption was seen as a remarkable, possibly uncalled-for, occasion. My family required remarkable occasions 3 times a day. They couldn't understand that the sort of meal they took for granted, a 30-minute production in the land of General Electric, translated here to a lifetime of travail. A family might as well sit waiting for mother and her attendants to come out of the kitchen with 3 Thanksgiving dinners a day. And Mama Tataba managed to do it, complaining all the while. She muttered while she worked, never resting, only pausing from time to time to hike up the waist of her wraparound panier underneath her wool sweater. She rolled her eyes whenever she had to undo my mistakes. The 10 cans I forgot to wash out and save, the bananas I failed to check for tarantulas, the firebox I once stoked entirely with sticks of bangala, the poisonwood tree. She slapped the match out of my hand as I bent to light it, then pulled out the green sticks one by one with a potholder, explaining tersely that the smoke alone would have killed us all. In the beginning, I knew no Kikongo beyond the practical words she taught me, so I was spared knowing how she cursed our mortal souls as even-handedly as she nourished our bodies. She pampered my ungrateful children and resented us utterly. She could reach her fingers deep into a moldy bag, draw out a miraculous ounce of white flour, and slap out biscuits. She rendered goat fat into something like butter and pulverized antelope meat into hamburgers with a device I think had been rigged from the propeller of a motorboat. She used a flat rock and the force of her will to smash groundnuts into passable peanut butter. And at the terminus of this long labor sat Rachel at the foot of the table, sighing, tossing her white hair from her shoulders, announcing that all she wished for in this world was jiffy, smooth, not crunchy. Fufu Nsala, Mama Tataba called us. I gathered this had to do with fufu, the food staple, not yet knowing Kikongo is a language that is not exactly spoken but sung. The same word slanted up or down the scale can have many different meanings. When Mama Tataba incanted this hymn to all of us under her breath, she was not calling us fufu eaters or fufu shunners or anything I could have guessed. Fufu Nsala is a forest-dwelling red-headed rat that runs from sunlight. I'd thought I was being brave. The very first time I went into the kitchen house, a snake slithered away from the doorstep, and a tarantula eyed me from the wall, hunkering down on his bandy legs like a football player on the offensive line. So I carried a big stick. I told Mama Tataba I'd grown up knowing how to cook, but not to be a circus trainer. Heaven only knows how she must have despised her pale rat of a cowering mistress. She couldn't have imagined the likes of an electric range or a land where women concern themselves with something called waxy yellow buildup. As much as she held me in contempt, she may never have had any real inkling of my true helplessness. I like to think she wouldn't have left us had she known. As it was, she left a pitched wake in which I felt I would drown. Strange to say, it was Nathan's frightful confidence in himself that drove her off. He believed, as I did, we were supposed to have come prepared. But there is no preparing for vipers on the doorstep and drums in the forest calling up an end to a century of affliction. By the time summer trailed off into the season of endless rains, it was clear there was going to be trouble. I couldn't stop imagining the deaths of my children. I dreamed them drowned, lost, eaten alive, dreamed it and woke in a stone-cold fright. When sleep refused to return, I lit the kerosene lamp and sat alone until dawn at our big dining room table, staring at the words of the Psalms to numb my mind. Lord, I have loved the habitation of thy house and the place where thine honor dwelleth. Gather not my soul with sinners, nor my life with bloody men. Redeem me. At sunrise, I sometimes left the house to walk. To avoid the river, I took the forest path. More than once, I startled elephant families browsing in the clearings. Woodland elephants are different from their grand cousins who stomp across the grasslands. They're smaller and more delicate, nuzzling through the leafy soil with rosy pink tusks. Sometimes in the dawn light, I also saw families of pygmies moving among the shadows, wearing nothing but necklaces of feathers and animal teeth, and on rainy days, hats made of leaves. They were so small, truly less than half my size, and so gaily decorated, I thought for a long time they were children. I marveled that whole bands of boys and girls were out in the forest all on their own, with knives and spears and infants strapped on their backs. Perhaps it was reading the Bible that had set my mind in such an open frame, ready to believe in any bizarre possibility. That and the lack of sleep. I needed to tie myself down by some kind of moorings, but there was no one at all to talk to. I tried poring over the American news magazines sent to us via the Underdowns, but I only found them disturbing. President Eisenhower spoke of having everything under control. The Kennedy boys said Uncle Ike was all washed up, and we need look no farther than the Congo. Congo. For evidence of poor U.S. leadership, the missile gap, and proof of the communist threat. The likes of Eleanor Roosevelt declared we ought to come forth with aid and bring those poor children into the 20th century. And yet, Mr. George F. Kennan, the retired diplomat, allowed that he felt not the faintest moral responsibility for Africa. It's not our headache, he said. Let them go communist if they feel like it. It was beyond me to weigh such matters when my doorstep harbored snakes that could knock a child dead by spitting in her eyes. But Nathan wouldn't hear my worries. For him, our life was as simple as paying in cash and sticking the receipt in your breast pocket. We had the Lord's protection, he said, because we came to Africa in his service. Yet we sang in church, Tata Inzolo, which means Father in Heaven or Father of Fish Bait, depending on just how you sing it. And that pretty well summed up my quandary. I could never work out whether we were to view religion as a life insurance policy or a life sentence. I can understand a wrathful God who'd just as soon dangle us all from a hook. And I can understand a tender, unprejudiced Jesus. But I could never quite feature the two of them living in the same house. You wind up walking on eggshells, never knowing which Tata Nzolo is home at the moment. Under that uncertain roof, where was the place for my girls? No wonder they hardly seemed to love me half the time. I couldn't step in front of my husband to shelter them from his scorching light. They were expected to look straight at him and go blind. Nathan, meanwhile, wrapped himself up in the salvation of Kilanga. Nathan, as a boy, played football on his high school team in Kildare, Mississippi, with great success, evidently, and expected his winning season to continue ever after. He could not abide losing or backing down. I think he was well inclined toward stubbornness and contemptuous of failure long before his conscription into the war and the strange circumstances that discharged him from it. After that, hounded by what happened in a Philippine jungle and the ghosts of a thousand men who didn't escape it, his steadfast disdain for cowardice turned to obsession. It's hard to imagine a mortal man more unwilling to change his course than Nathan Price. He couldn't begin to comprehend now how far off the track he was with his baptismal fixation. The village chief, Tata Ndu, was loudly warning people away from the church on the grounds that Nathan wanted to feed their children to the crocodiles. Even Nathan might have recognized this was a circumstance that called for reconciliation. But reconciliation with Tata Ndu was a mighty cross to bear. When he granted us an audience, he sat in a chair in his front yard looking away from us. He adjusted his tall hat made of sisal fibers. He took off and examined his large black glasses frames, which bore no lenses, and made every other effort at scholarly disinterest while Nathan talked. He flicked at flies with the official staff of his office, some sort of stiffened animal tail that ends in a silky white tassel. During the second interview, Nathan even retracted baptism as a specific program and suggested we might organize some kind of sprinkling. We eventually received a formal reply via the elder Ndu son, stating that sprinkling was all very well, but the previous Brother Fowles had disturbed the chief with peculiar ideas about having only one wife at a time. Imagine, Tata Ndu said, a shame-faced chief who could only afford one single wife. The chief expected us to disavow any such absurdities before he could endorse our church. My steadfast husband tore his hair in private. Without the chief's blessing, he could have no congregation. Nathan burned. There is no other way to say it. Many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivereth him out of them all, he declared to the sky, squinting up at God and demanding justice. I held him in my arms at night and saw parts of his soul turn to ash. Then I saw him reborn with a stone in place of his heart. Nathan would accept no more compromises. God was testing him like Job, he declared, and the point of that particular parable was that Job had done no wrong to begin with. Nathan felt it had been a mistake to bend his will in any way to Africa, to reshape his garden into mounds, to submit to Tata Ndu on the subject of river baptism, to listen at all to Tata Ndu or even the rantings of Mama Tataba. It had all been a test of Nathan's strength, and God was displeased with the outcome. He would not fail again. He noticed the children less and less. He was hardly a father except in the vocational sense, as a potter with clay to be molded. Their individual laughter he couldn't recognize, nor their anguish. He never saw how Ada chose her own exile, how Rachel was dying for the normal life of slumber parties and record albums she was missing. And poor Leah. Leah followed him like an underpaid waitress hoping for the tip. It broke my heart. I sent her away from him on every pretense I knew. It did no good. While my husband's intentions crystallized as rock salt, and while I preoccupied myself with private survival, the Congo breathed behind the curtain of forest, preparing to roll over us like a river. My soul was gathered with sinners and bloody men, and all I was thinking of was how to get Mama Tataba to come back, or what we should have brought from Georgia. I was blinded from the constant looking back, Lot's wife. I only ever saw the gathering clouds. The Things We Learned, Kilanga, June 30th, 1960. Leah Price. In the beginning, we were just about in the same boat as Adam and Eve. We had to learn the names of everything. Nkoko, Mongo, Zulu, river, mountain, sky. Everything must be called out from the void by the word we use to claim it. All God's creatures have names, whether they slither across our path or show up for sale at our front stoop. Bushbuck, mongoose, tarantula, cobra, the red and black monkey called Ngondo, geckos scurrying up the walls. Nile perch and Nkiende and electric eel dragged from the river. Akala, Nkento, Aana, man, woman, and child. And everything that grows, frangipani, jacaranda, mangwansi beans, sugarcane, breadfruit, bird of paradise. Nguba is peanut, close to what we call them at home, goober peas. Malala are the oranges with blood-red juice. Mankondo are bananas. Nanasi is a pineapple, and Nanasi Mputu means poor man's pineapple, a papaya. All these things grow wild. Our very own backyard resembles the Garden of Eden. I copy down each new word in my school notebook and vow to remember it always when I am a grown-up American lady with a backyard garden of my own. I shall tell all the world the lessons I learned in Africa. We've learned from the books left behind by Brother Fowles, field guides to the mammals and birds and the Lepidoptera, which are the butterflies. And we've learned from anyone, mostly children, who will talk to us and point at the same time. We've even had a surprise or two from our own mother, who grew up way deeper in Dixie than we did. As the buds on the trees turn to flowers, she raises her black eyebrows in surprise above her wide blue eyes and declares, "Bougainvillea, hibiscus, why, tree of heaven." Who would have thought Mother knew her trees? And the fruits, mango, guava, avocado, these we had barely glimpsed before in the big Kroger store in Atlanta, yet now the trees reach right down and deliver such exotic prizes straight into our hands. That's one more thing to remember when I'm grown, to tell about the Congo, how the mango fruits hung way down on long, long stems like extension cords. I believe God felt sorry for the Africans after putting the coconut so far out of reach and aimed to make the mango easier to get a hand on. I look hard at everything and blink as if my two eyes were a brownie camera taking photographs to carry back. At the people, too, who have names to be learned. Gradually, we've begun to call out to our neighbors. Closest by is poor, lame Mama Mwanza, who scurries down the road on her hands. And Mama Nguza, who walks with her head held strangely high on account of the giant goiter nestled like a goose egg under her chin. Tata Bwanda, the old fisherman, goes out in his boat every morning in the brightest red pair of trousers you ever saw in your life. People wear the same thing day in and day out, and that's how we recognize them, by and large. Mother says if they really wanted to put one over on us, they'd all swap outfits for a day. On cool mornings, Tata Bwanda also wears a light green sweater with a white border on the placket. He's quite a sight, with his muscular chest as manly as all get-out, framed by the V-neck of a lady's wear sweater. But if you think about it, how would he or anyone here even know it's a lady's sweater? How do I even know? Because of the styling, though it's nothing you could plainly describe. So is it even a lady's sweater here in the Congo? I wonder. There is something else I must confess about Tata Bwanda. He's a sinner. Right in the plain sight of God, he has two wives, a young and an old one. Why, they all come to church. Father says we're to pray for all three of them, but when you get down to the particulars, it's hard to know exactly what outcome to pray for. He should drop one wife, I guess, but for sure he'd drop the older one, and she already looks sad enough as it is. The younger one has all the kids, and you just can't pray for a daddy to flat out dump his babies, can you? I always believed any sin was easily rectified if only you let Jesus Christ into your heart, but here it gets complicated. Mama Bwanda number two doesn't seem fazed by her situation. In fact, she looks like she's fixing to explode with satisfaction. She and her little girls all wear their hair in short spikes bursting out all over their heads, giving an effect similar to a pincushion. Rachel calls it the haywire hairdo. And Mama Bwanda always wraps her panier just so, with a huge pink starburst radiating across her wide rump. The women's long cloth skirts are printed so gaily with the oddest things. There's no telling when a raft of yellow umbrellas or the calico cat and gingham dog or an upside-down image of the Catholic Pope might just go sauntering across our yard. Late in the fall, the milky green bushes surrounding every house and path suddenly revealed themselves as poinsettias. They bloomed their heads off, and Christmas rang out in the sticky heat as surprising as if Hark the Herald Angels were to come on your radio in July. Oh, it's a heavenly paradise in the Congo, and sometimes I want to live here forever. I could climb up trees just like the boys to hunt guavas and eat them till the juice runs down and stains my shirt forever. Only I am 15 now. Our birthday in December caught me off guard. Ada and I were late bloomers in terms of the bad things like getting breasts and the monthly visit. Back in Georgia, when my classmates started turning up in training brassieres one after another like it was a catching disease, I bobbed off my hair and vowed to remain a tomboy. With Ada and me doing college algebra and reading the fattest books we could get our hands on while the other kids trudged through each task in its order, I guess we'd counted on always being just whatever age we wanted to be. But no more. Now I'm 15 and must think about maturing into a Christian lady. To tell the truth, it's not purely paradise here either. Perhaps we've eaten of the wrong fruits in the garden because our family always seems to know too much and at the same time not enough. Whenever something big happens, we're quite taken aback, but no one else is in the least surprised. Not by a rainy season come and gone where none was supposed to be, nor by the plain green bushes changing themselves bang into poinsettias. Not by butterflies with wings as clear as little cat's eye glasses. Not by the longest or shortest or greenest snake in the road. Even little children here seem to know more than us, just as easily as they speak their own language. I have to admit that discouraged me at first, hearing the little kids jabbering away in Kikongo. How could little babies smaller than Ruth May speak this whole other language so perfectly? It's similar to the way Ada will sometimes turn up knowing some entire difficult thing like French or the square root of pi when I'd been taking for granted I knew everything she did. After we first arrived, the children congregated outside our house each and every morning, which confused us. We thought there must be something peculiar, such as a baboon, on our roof. Then we realized the peculiar thing was us. They were attracted to our family for the same reason people will pull over to watch a house afire or a car wreck. We didn't have to do a thing in the world to be fascinating, but move around in our house, speak, wear pants, boil our water. Our life was much less fascinating from my point of view. Mother gave us a few weeks' leeway on the school books, what with all the confusion of our settling in. But then in September, she clapped her hands together and declared, "Congo or not, it's back to school for you girls." She's determined to make us scholars, and not just the gifted among us, either. We were all chained together in her game plan. Each morning after breakfast and prayer, she sat us down at the table and poked the backs of our heads with her index finger, bending us over our school books, and Ruth May, her coloring, getting us in shape for purgatory, I'd reckon. Yet all I could concentrate on was the sound of the kids outside, the queer, glittery syllables of their words. It sounded like nonsense, but carried so much secret purpose. One mysterious phrase called out by an older boy could rout the whole group in shrieks and laughter. After lunch, she'd allow us a few precious hours to run free. The children would scream and bolt in terror when we came out, as if we were poisonous. Then, after a minute or two, they'd creep forward again, naked and transfixed, thrilled by our regular habits. Before long, they'd have reassembled themselves in a semicircle at the fringe of the yard, chewing on their pink sugar cane stalks and staring. A brave one would take a few steps forward, hold out a hand, and scream, "Kado!" before running away in horrified giggles. That was the closest thing to fellowship we had achieved so far, a shrieked demand for a gift. And what could we give them? We hadn't given a single thought to them wanting earthly goods and our planning ahead. We'd only brought things for ourselves. So I just tried to ignore the whole business as I lay in the hammock with my nose in the same book I'd already read three times. I pretended not to care that they watched me like a zoo creature or potential source of loot. They pointed and talked among themselves, lording it over me that their whole world left me out. My mother said, "Well, but sugar, it goes both ways. You know how to speak English, and they don't." I knew she was right, but I took no consolation from that. Speaking English was nothing. It wasn't a skill like being able to name all the capitals and principal products of South America, or recite scripture, or walk on top of a fence. I had no memory of ever having had to work hard for my native tongue. For a time, I did work hard to learn French, but then Ada ran away with that prize, so I dropped the effort. She could know French for the both of us, as far as I was concerned. Though I do have to say it seems an odd talent for someone who just on general principles refuses to talk. Back home, the idea of French had seemed like a parlor game anyhow. After we got here, it still did. These children have nothing to do with je suis vous êtes. They speak a language that burgles and rains from their mouths like water through a pipe. And from day one, I have coveted it bitterly. I wanted to get up from my hammock and shout something that would flush them up like a flock of scared ducks. I tried to invent or imagine such a stout, snappy phrase. "Buka buka," I imagined myself shouting. "We like Ike." Or, from a spaceship movie I had seen once, "Klaatu barada nikto." I wanted them to play with me. I suppose everyone in our family wanted the same in one way or another, to play, to bargain reasonably, to offer the word, to stretch a hand across the dead space that pillowed around us. Ruth May was the first one among us to get her way. That should have been no surprise, as Ruth May appears to be capable of leaping tall buildings with the force of her will. But who'd have thought a 5-year-old could establish communications with the Congolese? Why, she wasn't even allowed out of our yard. It was my job to keep her there, usually, with one eye always on the lookout for her to fall out of a tree and crack her head wide open. That really is the kind of thing Ruth May would do just for the attention. She was bound and determined to run off, and sometimes I had to threaten her with catastrophe just to keep her in check. Oh, I said awful things, that a snake might bite her, or that one of those fellows walking by and swinging his machete might just cut her gizzard out. Afterward, I always felt guilty and recited the repentance psalm, "Have mercy upon me, O God, according to the multitude of thy tender mercies." But really, with all those multitudes of tender mercies, he has got to understand sometimes you need to scare a person a little for her own good. With Ruth May, it's all or nothing. As soon as I had her good and terrified, I'd slip away. I'd go hunt for the pygmies who are supposed to be dwelling right under our noses in the forest, or for monkeys, easier to spot. Or I'd cut up fruit for Methuselah still hanging around begging and catch grasshoppers for Leon, the chameleon we keep in a wooden crate. Mother lets us keep him on the condition we never bring him in the house, which is funny because I found him inside the house. His bulging eye sockets swivel whichever way they please, and we love to get his eyes going so one looks up and the other down. He catches the grasshoppers we throw in his box by whipping out his tongue like a slingshot. I could also try to talk Father into letting me tag along with him. There was always that possibility. Father spends his days making rounds through the village, trying to strike up chats with the idle old men, or venturing farther afield to inspect the state of grace in the neighboring villages. There are several little